From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview from the archives with the author Catherine Guare, who lives in the Vermont town where she grew up, part of the third generation of her family to call the tiny capital city of Montpelier home. She's the author of the Connor McBride series of three books, Where a Wave Meets the Shore, the first of the McBride family chronicles, and a guide to Vermont's capital city called Five Walks Through Montpelier. What Are You Looking At? Book 1, published in 2019. She spent 10 years as an executive with a global health membership and advocacy organization, worked as a tour coordinator in a travel agency, and has traveled extensively in Europe and India. She has a passion for classical music, all things Celtic, and exploring ethnic foods and diverse cultures. Her first novel, Deceptive Cadence, was awarded 2 gold medals in the Reader's Favorite Awards, one for Best Suspense Thriller and one for Best Audiobook. In this interview, we discuss her novel Deceptive Cadence. Here's a little information about the book. For the Irish, family is everything. Their loyalty to each other is unbreakable. But Connor McBride thought his had reached its limit. He had spent years trying to undo the damage of a betrayal that humiliated him, ended his career, and nearly landed him in prison for a crime he never committed. The man responsible for it all disappeared long ago. Connor never thought of searching for him, but now a secretive stranger from London has traveled to his farm in the west of Ireland, asking him to do exactly that. Wanting to refuse but knowing he can't, Connor accepts a job he doesn't want, acquiring deadly skills he never wanted to learn. He's an ordinary man, but before long he will hardly recognize himself. He will disappear into a ruthless new identity on the tumultuous streets of India, joining allies he doesn't trust in a dangerous game without rules. He will learn to shoot, lie, steal, and smother his humanity under layers of tradecraft, all in service to the one goal of finding the man who took everything from him, his brother, Thomas McBride. Thomas has one last chance for redemption, and Connor will do whatever it takes to find him before it's too late. Because the bond between brothers goes on forever, even after betrayal. Family is everything. When I spoke with Catherine Guare in 2013, I began by asking her what inspired her to write Deceptive Cadence, the first novel in the Connor McBride series. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Well, I don't think when I started it that I actually even knew I was really writing a book. I started with just a character and a scene, and I didn't know much about him or what he was doing or why he was where he was, and I knew there were certain things about him. He'd clearly been through some kind of trauma that I didn't even yet understand. So the inspiration, I just guess, came from that one scene where I was interested in knowing more about what was going to happen to this person, and
so had you taken a class? What, like, did you just decide you wanted to start writing?
Well, I've written a lot in the past because I am a journalism major. I studied journalism at St. Michael's College, and I've done just a lot of writing over the years. My father was a journalist, and so it's kind of in the blood, I guess. I've written for jobs, different types of copy for magazines for the organization or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I'm pretty experienced with writing, but had never written a novel before.
Okay. So you just sat down and said, I'm going to see what happens with this character because he's of interest to me.
Yeah, it was almost sort of just exercises. You know, I'd write down a few scenes and sort of just disparate scenes would come into my head and I would just write them down, and they didn't really necessarily go together. Yeah. And there are characters that and scenes that I wrote that never ended up being in the book but might end up being in the next one. And it very, very slowly came together. I just started to know more about who he was. I started to get a sense of what his background was and what was happening to him. And at some point, it started to move forward. It started to be a little bit more chronological, and scenes started to connect to each other and make sense.
So how long ago was that you started it?
I'm embarrassed to say, it was probably like 15 years ago that the first ones came into my head and I started to write those down. Okay. And in truth, the very, very first scene that I wrote, I actually looked at some of my old notebooks and things like that, and I found actually some pages that are from a typewriter. Actually, I was writing it on a typewriter. That's a long, long time ago. That's more than 15 years ago.
Do you
ago.
Still have your typewriter?
No.
You can't even
find one anymore.
I'm really sad. I had a typewriter that was a high school graduation gift from my dad, and I got rid of it. And now I'm like, that was stupid.
I know. You need labels every once in a while. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I wonder if we can talk a little bit about what your approach is to plotting a suspense novel, which I think sometimes is a little bit different than plotting a quieter novel or a novel that doesn't have a line of suspense through the narrative. So did you outline anything at a certain point once you had all these scenes, or did you always sort of...
I played around with a couple of different methodologies, and I just switched back and forth depending on which one would work. For the most part, there wasn't a great outline that I was going with, but when I got stuck at a certain point in the middle of the book where I was pretty far into it and I was getting confused, and I thought, I need to get this organized. And so I actually made a flow chart of everything that was more, you know, this led to this and that, and it looped back up to this. And there were a couple of plot points that I didn't really understand myself, so I tried to draw a chart of sort of this complicated thing that was happening and tried to make it make sense to me. And I think one of the biggest challenges is to try and make it so that it's simple enough to understand, so that people just don't get completely confused and check out and say, I can't follow this.
Right.
And make it complex enough so that it's interesting and you're drawn along and want to know what happens, and it's confusing enough to be intriguing.
Right.
But not so confusing that it just turns the reader off.
Well, one thing that's really great is that this book, it goes to really unusual places. I mean, both geographically and plot-wise, you know, I mean, you go to India, you know, it starts out in Ireland, it ends up in India. You're talking about MI6. It seemed to me like you must have had to do a lot of research for all of these various things. But just what you're saying now reminds me that it's complicated, but it's not too complicated. It seems like a good balance, and it also isn't just the same old regular mystery with the same old alcoholic cop. You know, it's really different. Like, you would never be able to anticipate, when you started the book, necessarily who these people were going to be or where it was going to go. So,
and it's interesting, I've learned a lot in creating the book, and actually when I was finished it, trying to understand what genre it was in, to understand the big variety of genres that are just within mystery and suspense. You know, there are police procedurals and different, there's something now called a cozy mystery or a cozy thriller, and so that was an education as well, to know the different styles and the ones that I didn't fit into as well as where I thought it did.
So what do you call your genre?
I think a suspense mystery is the one that people seem to connect with. A few people have said that they think of thriller as something scarier, almost, you know, like a ghost story thriller or something.
Like, and I thought, verging on horror almost.
Right. So I kind of think I stuck to suspense mystery because it's also not a typical thriller in the sort of Tom Cruise, James Bond, a very suave, debonair, superhuman hero who just seems to be able to do everything, which is kind of what a lot of thriller genres have as their central character. And this one's a very different kind of character. He's an amateur.
Right. He's pretty good at it.
He's pretty good. He's got skills.
He's got skills. So, okay, so now that we're talking about Connor, let's talk about his character, developing Connor's character, and also just sort of generally creating a new hero for what's looking like it will be a series of suspense novels. So how did you go about creating him?
Well, going back to that first scene, he was there. He popped up in the scene that I wrote.
Right.
And I knew he was going to be Irish because he was in Ireland when I was writing that scene. But I really wanted to create a character that was, as I say, very different from, you know, somebody that is not a professional spy. He's got a completely different life. And as I developed the character, I wanted him to be a musician. Mm-hmm. And I love the violin. I love listening to all kinds of fiddle, violin, classical, Irish music. He's Irish, so I thought it would be great if he was a fiddle player. And I made him a classical violinist, but he can do both, really. Mm-hmm. And then there was sort of the sort of plot twist, which is that his career was ruined, and he ends up back on the farm. So he's a farmer, he's a violinist, he's about to become a spy, and he's sort of a reserved kind of person.
So you said a second ago that his career is ruined, and if it's okay, I'll just say that his career is ruined by a family member. We won't get too specific. Mm-hmm. And then that same family member is sort of the reason that he ends up getting drawn into the work that he does as a spy.
Mm-hmm.
When did that, and I'm going to ask you more about that later, but when did that come to you as like how far into the plot process were you when you kind of thought, okay, well, this is what is going to launch him on his path?
Mm-hmm. I think that came fairly early because the next thing that happened after the scene was that I had a scene of him in a London office speaking to an MI6 officer.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, it was the end of the story. So that scene was really, a lot of the action had already happened, even though I didn't know what that action was. So he was kind of in this scene with the MI6 officer, and it had gone very badly. And I needed it to have a very personal component.
Uh-huh.
I thought it was important that it be personally devastating to him, that whatever it was that had been going on,
right,
really affected him. And it had taken him away from something that was important to him, too.
Yeah.
So all of that sort of fed into, this is making it more of something to do with his family.
Yeah.
That just made it a little bit deeper and made his character more complex for me, that he wasn't just on some mission, that generic mission that didn't have anything to do with him. He was on something
right.
that was really personally important and that he needed to be invested in.
And then he's really sort of the only person that they can turn to because of the personal situation that has arisen. And so that makes so much more sense than this violinist becoming a spy. It wouldn't happen.
Right.
I mean, possibly nothing would happen, but this is a lot more believable.
Right.
You know.
And I don't think it's giving too much away to say that the family member was his brother. I mean, it's on the back cover
oh, okay.
of the book, so
okay.
we can talk about that.
Yeah.
But that it's his brother, and there's also a feeling of personal betrayal there, because he's, as the book opens, he has spent the past 5 years thinking that his brother ruined his career intentionally,
and sort of that he'd
gotten himself into trouble and he'd implicated his Connor, and so he has spent a very long time thinking that everything he wanted from his career is gone, and the person that is to blame is somebody that he was really close to. So he's got that sort of confusion as well, and just hopefully lots of emotional complexity going on.
Absolutely, yeah, totally. Okay, so it says on the back, the debut of a new hero in international suspense. Mm-hmm. So it is a series, and the series is called The Virtuosic Spy. So where mm-hmm. did you come up with that, The Virtuosic Spy?
That came very late, and it was actually when the publisher suggested I have a subtitle for the book.
Okay.
Because they said that, you know, Deceptive Cadence, it was a great title, it was intriguing, but that it was, since it was going to be a series, that it would be good if the series itself also had its own kind of tagline, and that the book would be helped if it had a subtitle. So those two things sort of went together.
Okay. So The Virtuosic Spy will be on all of them, and they will have different titles.
Yep. So the next one is whatever the title is, and it'll be The Virtuosic Spy Book 2.
Yeah. Okay.
And it really became, it's the second book in the series is actually, a lot of the material came from just the overall process of writing the first book. So even though it took me years, I like to say that, I was actually writing two books at once. And at some point in writing, I realized that I just had too much material and there were too many things going back and forth. A lot of the first book was being told in flashbacks. And so at some point I realized the flashbacks are the story, and I just need to tell this tale chronologically, yeah, instead of trying to wrap too much into it and try to get this story across in flashbacks.
That's such a hard thing, to figure out the timing of a novel and to figure out how much flashback is okay, mm-hmm, and what is your storyline, like where is it in the timeline. So did you come up with a timeline, or did you...
I did, and my timeline actually is, it starts with the birth of his parents.
Oh, wow.
So I have kind of like a whole backstory for him and his family. So I have sort of the key events in his life and in the family's life on a very brief timeline. It's very high level, but it spans the actions of the two books together.
Okay.
Yeah, and the flashback, I think when I knew that it was too much flashback, it was when the flashbacks were like, you know, 50 pages of flashback, and now we're returning to the present day, and we have one chapter, and then he's going to, you know, go back into a... It was just clear. It just kind of jumped out at me that that's what I needed to do.
Yeah. Okay, great. I wanted to talk a little bit about researching the book. I said before, there's so much to understand, or for the author to understand, and you explain it so well to us, but for you, you had to understand certain things about Ireland, India, espionage, MI6, and there's just little things too. You know, there are lines of Gaelic in the book. So how much of this did you already know about? How much did you know through just your own life? And how much did you have to really research, and how did you go about that?
Well, I've been to both India and Ireland.
Okay.
Several times. So the general atmosphere of those two places was something I was really familiar with, so I felt very comfortable describing the way it looked, the way it smells, the general feeling, mm-hmm, of those two places, and the specific cities and areas that I talk about in there. I don't know very much Irish at all. Cadmiel Felta, Sláinte, that sort of thing. So I did have to do a lot of research, and that was fun. That was so much fun. You can find a lot on YouTube.
Oh,
people,
yeah.
People speaking or singing Irish songs, and I actually got a book off Amazon that had a lot of phrases in it, and just so I did look into that and tried to learn, as well as the Irish language. There was a book I read that talked about the way English is spoken in Ireland.
Oh, good.
And how it's really influenced by the Irish language and some of the sort of quirks of the sort of traditional Irish brogue are influences from the way they structured a phrase in Irish carries over to the way they say it in English.
Sure.
So that was helpful. And I had a book of, it's called Slanguage, that was printed in Ireland, which is just basically a big dictionary of Irish slang terms.
Oh, fine.
And that was interesting. And then the worry is that you have all of these sort of academic things that you've been researching and looking at, and you wonder, but do they really talk like that? Do they really say that? So I tried not to go too overboard on any of it because I wanted it to sound authentic.
Yeah.
So I sprinkle it in there,
yeah,
and try not to make it sound too diddle-diddle Lucky Charms kind of Irish accent kind of talk. But I can say it's interesting because one of the people that has bought the book since it was published is my long-lost Irish cousin that found me on Facebook.
Oh, no way.
And he bought the book, and I said, you know, I really want to know, because I actually hadn't had any Irish people read it. And I said, I really want to know if it sounds authentic and if the people talking sound. And finally I wrote, and he was saying, oh, I'm really enjoying the book, really enjoying the book. And I said, so did it sound authentic to you? What did you think? And he said, I thought it was bloody brilliant. I was like, okay.
Yay!
I think I've got it.
You looked it up in Slanguage and that was good.
Yeah, and that was it. That's what they say.
Okay, well, before we go too much further, I wonder if you want to read a couple pages just to give people a sense of what it's like.
I thought I would read just sort of part of one of the first scenes
Okay.
in the book.
Sure.
So this is the very beginning of the book when he is on his farm in Dingle, and he's just been told that there is a mysterious visitor that has arrived at his house, and he's been called from the fields to go meet this stranger. He stepped through into the large living and dining room, still brightly lit from the sun that poured through the casement windows opposite the fireplace. A tall, silver-haired man stood at one window, a teacup cradled in his hand as he looked out at the green pastures and the distant ocean. He appeared to be lost in thought. Connor made his presence known with a discreet shuffle of feet before speaking. "How are you, sir? I'm Connor McBride. Sorry to have kept you waiting." Without a hint of being startled, the figure gracefully turned to face him, a smile of welcome on his face. For a fleeting moment, Connor had an impression of role reversal, as if he were the one paying a visit. "Connor, it's very good of you to see me." The man's voice had a deep, rich timbre. The accent was quintessential public school English, and his attire, beautifully tailored suit, tasteful striped tie, and gleaming cap-toed shoes, indicated a fastidious sense of style. "I'm taking you from your work, I'm afraid." "You are indeed," Connor smiled. "Don't think I'm not grateful. Will you take another cup of tea?" The offer was graciously declined. Connor invited him to take a seat next to the fireplace, and sat down in the one across from it. He waited for the visitor to introduce himself. The visitor seemed in no hurry to do so. "I had the opportunity of hearing you play last evening in Tralee," he said, crossing his legs and looking as if they were already old friends. The unexpected opening startled Connor. "I hope you enjoyed it." "I enjoyed it immeasurably." The large hazel eyes widened for emphasis. "I have rarely heard Locatelli's capriccios played so confidently, or so well. It was an extraordinary display of virtuosity." "Thank you." "I must admit I was quite astonished. Do you play often with that ensemble?" "No. No, they're just over from Dublin for a few nights. I'd played with them before, and the manager rang last month to ask me to be in the program." Connor twitched a self-deprecating grin. "Most nights you're more likely to find me fiddling for the crowd down at the pub here." "Certainly a far cry from the National Symphony Orchestra, isn't it?" The elegant stranger inclined his head in sympathetic appraisal. "What a waste. I didn't fully comprehend it until I heard you last night. Not your fault, of course, but what a criminal, bloody waste." Offered in a silky undertone, the observation struck with precision, like a concealed switchblade sliding between his ribs. It left Connor speechless. The voice across from him continued in a low murmur. "How bitter that must have been, to lose your seat in the first violins, not to mention your growing career as a soloist. To trade hard-won success and recognition for this pastoral obscurity on the edge of the sea. All because someone had to do penance for your brother's crimes." Connor's face had already lost its polite smile and most of its color. At this last remark, he came up out of the chair, rigid with anger. "I half expected something like this," he said coldly. "Who the hell are you?"
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Oh, okay. We didn't hear his name yet.
Oh, no, I know.
That was Frank. So I have a question about Frank.
Mysterious MI6 officer.
MI6. So I'm gonna skip to the question about Frank. There's a couple different spies in the book that we get to know. Frank, who's, he's sort of managerial and overseas, and then Sedgwick. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to talk in detail about these two men and their role, but you can. But talk about designing the other spies in the book and their different personalities and just how you kind of approached them.
Frank, I visualized very vividly in my head, and as you can hear, I hear him talking in my head. So I have this picture of him as a very proper, sort of erect, distinguished English gentleman, very, he'd fit into Downton Abbey very well, very proper, and but very humorous also, and And there's a real affection that he has for Connor. It's not specifically stated in the book itself, but in my sort of backstory of him, he's spent a lot of time getting to know Connor before he actually gets to that meeting where he sees him. He's studied him, and he's a spy, so he's done all of his homework.
Right.
And in my mind, he has already developed an affection for him and his story. And he's a very refined person, so he enjoys good music. So he's got a real respect for his talent. So it's a matter of Connor being very, who the hell are you?
Right.
And Frank is sort of this counterpoint to Connor's more down to earth, Irishness. So I think they have lots of good kind of comical exchanges and also some kind of poignant exchanges as they sort of get to know each other and as Connor reluctantly begins to like him in spite of himself and in spite of the fact that he doesn't trust him as far as he can throw him. He sort of starts to develop an affection for him.
Now, when you were introducing, let's say, that scene, and you stopped at a certain point just because we're having this interview, but as the scene progresses, it becomes clear that there's going to be pushback on both sides. Frank has something he wants, and Connor has, a certain reluctance. When you got into writing a situation like that, is it ever tempting for you to just sort of like rush it along and be like, okay, he's gonna do what Frank wants, or is it hard for you at all to kind of keep the suspense and the tension running through?
Sometimes it is. I think I sometimes do both, because I think sometimes I make the scene too long and it has to be edited down later so that it does keep moving along.
So sometimes you feel like you, in your first draft, you overdo the
interaction and the back and forth and the tension and then feel like this is going on a little too long.
Oh, that's interesting. Because see, my way of dealing with it would be just like to buffalo right on through, and I'm going to have to go back and make it longer.
And I do that as well. And actually, for this initial scene, and actually there was one editor that said he seems to decide awfully quickly. But as I went through the book, I was just kind of like, I want to get the story underway. So I didn't have an awful lot of scenes where, there's one scene right after this one where he's having a conversation with his mother about it, and he's dithering and he's kind of raging that he doesn't want to get involved in this. His brother is, betrayed him, and he doesn't want to get involved anymore. He doesn't care. He's involved in some other kind of scheme and he's just not interested. But that's it. That's the scene. And then he realizes, there's one paragraph where it's like he's, shrugs his shoulders and realizes he's going to have to do this.
Right.
Because I didn't want to take up an awful lot more words to have him resisting it.
Okay.
So.
All right. You just mentioned his mother, and I wanted to talk a little bit about her. There's a general sense that she has some intuition, some clairvoyance that's more than what most of us have.
Mm-hmm.
And he almost seems to have a little bit of that, too. Sometimes it feels like he's inherited some of her sense of, I don't know, we used to call it ESP. But, she just sort of understands things that haven't been clarified yet. So, was that, I know I keep asking, when did that happen? When did you decide that? But it all fits so well together, and it's really fun to read. So how did you come to include her and that aspect of her personality?
I think it comes from the love that I have for Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And there are so many things that I love. And a lot of the book really is like I took the things that I like and I put them in my book. I love everything that about Celtic mysticism, the holy wells, the there are passage tombs and Newgrange and sort of these the fairies and the little people and their fascination there and their continued fascination to this day. And I just really wanted to have a character in it, and I thought it made sense that it'd be his mother and that she was a very powerful influence on him. And that he has inherited some of her sort of second sight and instincts and that sort of thing, because it just fascinates me, and I wanted to include that as part of his experience as well.
Right. Now, you're from Irish descent, mm-hmm. I'm assuming. That
yes.
You're from, are you 100% Irish? Or?
Pretty much. Three quarters or yeah. seven-eighths or yeah. something like that.
So did you get those stories when you were a kid? Did your parents tell you stories of the fairies and the little people? Or
We had a few books that we'd read that, yeah. that were, you know, Finding the Pot of Gold and, you know, really kind of the really cutesy
yeah.
books. But it wasn't really until I got older and read more I just became fascinated with the whole passage tombs and passage graves
right,
and
right.
Cork. We went to Ireland and I dragged my parents all over fields looking at dolmens and things like that. And they were like, this is great. Can we go to the pub now? But so I don't know. I do tend to do that too. I get enthusiasms for things and,
yeah.
and I just kind of want to learn everything I can about them. And,
yeah.
And then they ended up in the book.
Well, I think one thing that's really interesting about America is it's still such a new country that I think a lot of the people who live in America know where they come from and have a certain amount of knowledge and pride in that background, even if it has nothing to do with our day-to-day lives. You know, I was raised, we're seven-eighths Irish, mm-hmm. you know, and I heard all these stories, and my father took me to see Darby O'Gill and the Little People. It was mm-hmm. one of my first movies, and, mm-hmm. and it, you know, there's just always just the sense of this is where you're from, and these are who your people were, you know, and
right.
and that's fun. So,
and it's also interesting because what you just said made me think of this, is that we don't have that sort of mythology in America that
right.
they have in Ireland,
yeah.
where they talk about the cattle raid of Cooley,
yeah.
which is it's something that you could almost read and wonder, did this actually happen, or
right.
is this just one of those made up mythological things? They have so many heroes that are sort of at some point you go back in Irish history and you get to this point where it's kind of iffy as to whether did these people really exist or
mm.
And that's fascinating for me too, because
yeah.
we don't really have the same kind of thing here where
right.
things go back eons.
Right. Well, we don't have the buildings that go back hundreds or even, you know, almost 1,000 years, some of these old
right.
stone structures, you know, and
mm.
all of that that there will be stories about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. The title of the book, Deceptive Cadence, you do explain it at a certain point in the book. Did that come before the description, or did the description come and then you thought, oh, that'll make a great title?
This is an interesting story because this gets to another enthusiasm that I went through, which was I got very involved in the great courses, those
oh,
audio
yeah,
courses.
Sure.
And there's one that's just fabulous called How to Listen to and Understand Great Music.
Oh, I have that.
Do you have it? It's Professor Robert Greenberg, I think, is the lecturer.
I think so, okay.
And he's wonderful. He's funny and erudite and full of great information, and he makes it very interesting. And I had a job where I commuted every day for an hour both ways, so mm-hmm. I listened to lots of things on tape. And one of the things was, you know, just to become more familiar with concert music. He said, it's not classical music. You call it concert music. And so I listened to a lot of that, and he has a section in the lecture where he's talking about terms, different types of chords,
mm.
and different types of cadences,
okay.
and they just did seem to me to lend themselves to different things that you could apply to life about
sure.
an open cadence or
yeah.
the plagal cadence, which is the amen cadence at the end of something, and I just was fascinated by that. And the deceptive cadence is, as he describes it, a progression of chords that you expect to go in a certain direction and come to a satisfying conclusion. And that's something I never thought about until I listened to him, which is, as you're listening to music, there's a feeling you get when it's like a certain chord comes and you sort of rest.
Yeah.
It's sort of like it's that part is done. And the deceptive cadence is where you are sitting there and expecting that the next chord is going to be the rest, the tonic, as it's called. And it's not. It goes somewhere completely different.
Right.
And you're not done yet.
Yeah.
And it creates a sense of tension, which I can feel now as I listen to music. It's not an unpleasant tension, but you do notice it a little bit more that that there's more to experience in music once you know what you're listening to.
Exactly, yeah. I haven't listened to that great course yet. I have it, but I haven't listened
to
it.
Yeah, he's great.
And so I also wanted to talk about the cover of the book, which is lovely. How did you go about, I know that you had design suggestions, and how did you go about getting it created for you?
Well, this was a wonderful experience. This was one of the best experiences of getting the entire book published was the, I thought I knew what I wanted the cover to be. You know, you sort of go into it and it's like, here's the picture I really like. And,
yeah.
But along with that, I, to the designer, who was part of the whole publishing team that published the book. So the cover designer was part of the entire team that I worked with, to get the book published. And you complete a survey to get them started so that they can start from something.
Right.
And give them a lot of ideas. So I sort of just spewed lots of different images, themes, things like that. But in addition, I sent her two specific pictures and I said, you know, this is really what I had in mind. And you could almost see that she probably thought, okay. So she worked away and pulled one of the images and she did the cover and she sent me six different covers that I could look at. And I opened the first one, which was the picture I had chosen, and I was like, oh my God, that's awful. It just didn't look, it looked really Mickey Mouse-ish or something. It just didn't, it looked, it screamed, you know, amateur cover photo or amateur.
Oh, okay.
And not that she hadn't done a good job with it, but just it just wasn't the right image at all.
Right.
And so I was panicking already. I'd only opened one of them, and I was like, oh, no. And then I think the book cover, the main part of the design that she'd created was the third file I opened, and I loved it.
Yeah.
And she had, what I thought was so ingenious was that she'd created something that wasn't too literal. And a lot of people don't really know what they're even looking at when they
right.
look at the cover. And some people think that's bad. Some people think that's, you know, people are too befuddled when they look at the cover. But I thought it was great.
Yeah.
I thought it was, she put the two violin scrolls together and she just created the little shape in the middle that sort of suggests India. And then there's marigolds on the cover of the book, and that's the marigold flower plays some significance in one of the climactic scenes of
yeah.
the book.
Yeah.
So I just was in love with it. We played around with it a bit. We took the fonts from one of the previous designs and put it into this design. So there were some things that we did with it, but
yeah.
the basic design was immediate.
And it's perfect because it's on a black background, which to me is good for suspense. You know, it mm-hmm. kind of makes you think, you know, a little bit on the dark side there, but it is a beautiful cover. And then the lettering is sort of vaguely Irish. Right? Or is it not vague? Is that an Irish font?
It is. I actually don't know, but I did tell her that I wanted, because when we were, that was one of the things we changed, because the photo, the image was great, but I said I'd like to get across some kind of sense of Irish.
Yeah.
Because as I was talking to people who I thought were probably going to be my reader, my target audience, it's clear that a lot of them were just thrilled with the idea of reading a book that had Irish stuff in it.
Yeah.
And not so many of them, you know, a lot of them who have read it are very intrigued by the India introduction for them. But I thought I really would like it to have something on the outside that says this has some Irish
sure. well,
themes
and,
in it.
And Irish is your demographic too. So, mm-hmm. you know, as the author, you know, it's good that you have an Irish a nod to the Irish on the cover.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I did tell her I'd like to get. And then we played around with the middle image, and she put some shamrocks in it, and that looked awful. So finally we just stuck with, we'll let the font of the cover suggest the Irish theme. So.
Right. Well, and the green. And also,
and the green.
I think that the marigolds catch the eye better than shamrocks would.
Definitely.
I mean, the orange is just really pops, and it's beautiful. Okay. So you mentioned that, you know, this was part of the publishing team's work. So talk a little bit about your experience of getting published, mm-hmm. if you would.
I figured that I would be doing it like the traditional process happens.
Right.
And I finished the book. I had it first just had people read it. And so I did an enormous amount of editing and rewriting myself at first. I did hire a professional developmental editor to go through and pick out things, and that helped a lot to tighten a lot of the story. So before I was ready to send it out, I did all that. And then I started sending queries to agents, and the rejections started to come in, and actually the rejection was, you know, a good outcome because there were so many that just don't even send anything.
Right.
So I actually used a service for that as well, Writer's Relief, which was a group that helps you target which agents would maybe be best for your particular kind of book.
Okay.
And about 50, I would say, we went. I went to 50 agents. There were four or five that read the full manuscript. It took a really long time, months, just to get to that point where I had sent them all out. I was waiting for responses. They would get a book. They would read it. They would take a month and let me know that they didn't want it. And really, I just thought, well, this is going to take years. And I just thought, I don't really want to wait that long.
Yeah.
And it might never happen. Because it's such a changing industry, and tastes are so difficult, or the agents, I think, even themselves are struggling to try and figure out what's the next thing that we should just buy up all of.
Right.
And I thought, I just don't think I can. I just want to share the book with people.
Yeah.
And it would be nice if I felt like I had been chosen to be published, but I thought, the more I thought about it, that was less important to me. The more important thing was that this was something I wanted to do, and I wanted to put it in front of an audience and let them decide if it was worth it or not.
Right.
And so that's when I decided to do the self-publishing route. And I did a lot of research online to just try and find what seemed like the most reputable. Apparently, there are just lots of them out there that aren't very reputable, and also some that are very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And I just compared, I read reviews, compared service packages, and eventually went with a group that's called Mill City Press. And it's kind of overarching media company is called Hillcrest Media. What I did like about them was that they have imprints. So you don't, when you're having a printed book created and the reader opens the book, they don't just see CreateSpace or Author House as the imprint. They had nice sounding imprints, Two Harbors Press, Langdon Street Press were a couple of them, even Mill City Press. So they sounded professional. It had a, you know, the, so right away it's, that made me feel better about it. It has a professional ring to it. They had a set of elements in their package that were, I thought the most cost effective. They included a website. They designed a website for me. There were a lot of services that they provided that now that I've done it once, I might say, I think I can do that myself. But at the time, I had no idea.
Sure. Overwhelming. There's just so much to know, to do, to even know that you're supposed to do.
It is. Just ISBN numbers. Where do you go for those? LCCN numbers. How do you do that? Copyright. All of those things alone were beyond me. A reputable printer to print the book. A designer to design the cover. I could have done all of those things myself, but it would have, again, it would have taken me a long time to research and find the right people. And this group had good reviews, and people had said good things about them. So so that's why I went with them.
Okay. Now, did you keep track as time went by about all the things they were doing for you, so that if you decide to do it differently next time, you know what steps you need to take and all of that?
Definitely. I mean, there are a lot of things that now that I know, it's like, well, that just doesn't take any time at all.
Yeah.
They have the social media parts of it, especially. They will create a Facebook page for you. That's just not that hard to do.
Yeah.
I mean, when you look at them and you don't know anything, your first reaction is, I don't know how to do this.
Right.
But you spend an hour and you figured it out, and right. the page is up, and it's done, and I didn't have to pay $100 for it. Yeah. So there are a lot of things like that. And
now, were some of those things optional?
For the package, if you bought a certain level of package, it was just included.
Okay.
None of the social media parts are, though. That's sort of different. That's a whole media and marketing package that you could have bought. And I didn't go with that because I didn't have the budget for it. And as I looked at a lot of those things, I thought, these are things I can figure out myself.
Yeah. Are you on Twitter?
I am on Twitter, and I'm struggling to appreciate Twitter.
Yeah.
It's becoming slowly. I actually had a breakthrough. Was a stranger on Twitter wrote and said, "Oh, your book looks great. I'm going to try it." And last week wrote me again and said, "I read it and it's fantastic." And awesome. That's the first, my book's only been out for a few weeks, so I haven't had any real strangers buy the book yet.
That's really good, yeah.
So, yeah, I was excited by that, and I thought, ooh, Twitter doesn't stink so bad after all.
Twitter sold me a book.
Yeah, so I'll stick with Twitter.
There we go.
And I'm sort of just exploring other tools now that help you add Twitter followers and do it in a way that's a little bit more targeted and strategic than I had been doing it, which was just sort of randomly follow people.
Yeah.
And this seems like it's working out.
All right. What are you working on now?
I am working on book two.
Okay.
And I am about 3/4 of the way through the first draft.
Okay.
Which is a continuation of the story. And he is going to have a love interest in the second book. It's a little bit more romance in the second book, but still adventure, suspense, mystery, mayhem.
Okay, cool. What's a book that you've read recently that you liked?
The book that I'm reading right now is an Anthony Trollope.
Oh, yeah.
I started reading his Palliser series a couple of years ago, and I got into it, and then I didn't get through it fast enough, so I had to start over at the beginning.
Okay.
But I just am reading right now Phineas Redux, which is the story of Phineas Finn, who is an Irishman.
Yeah.
And I love Anthony Trollope. There's just something, he's such a witty, dry writer who does wonderful things with characters. And does wonderful things with female characters, which is a little different in an author of that age. I think he 1860s or something
writing.
And he has really strong, intelligent women in his books, and he puts them in situations that are engaging, and there's a lot of politics in them as well, but just the character development I find superb.
Now, how many are in that series?
In that series, I think there are maybe 6 or 7 books.
Okay.
I think it's going to take me all my life to get through Trollope, definitely, because then there's the Barchester something series, and he wrote a lot,
Okay.
So I really enjoy him.
All right, great. So my last question is, we already talked about the fact that the storyline that gets Connor to participate at all in this espionage activity has to do with his family, his brother. And so that's his character motivation, sort of, or it's the early part of his character motivation. So I just wonder if you could talk for just a minute about the importance of creating character motivation and any advice you have for people about how to create motivation in their characters.
I think if you have taken enough time to really get to know your character, it's easier to understand what's going to motivate them, what's going to push their buttons, and what's going to make them think or behave in certain ways, and then you'll start to understand. So the more you know the character you're writing about, the more you'll understand what you're writing is in character.
Okay.
So you'll write something and then be able to say, Connor wouldn't say something like that, or he wouldn't behave that way.
Right.
And I think you really do need to sort of think about the whole person that you're writing about, and even where he came from. Who are his parents? What were his parents like? What was his childhood like? I mean, maybe that sounds really extreme, but for me it was important to feel like I just knew an awful lot about this character so that I could write about him.
And did you find that some of what you knew about him came as you wrote him?
A lot of it
Yeah.
Because you'd get to a scene and then you'd realize something that he doesn't like, or a part of his character that you hadn't realized before, that all of a sudden clicks.
Yeah.
And may, it's sort of like, it's sort of like something else that you just sort of tack on to him as he's goes forward, and you might use that again later. Uh-huh. So.
Okay. All right. That's great. Thank you very much. This was really fun.
Thank you.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Vermont author Catherine Guare. You can learn more about her work at CatherineGuare.com. This week's Write the Book prompt is to think about where you'd most like to be quarantined and write about what would meet your expectations as you spent time in that place and what might defy them. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on iTunes and Spotify and lots of other podcast sites. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all the other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, SheLaughsWithoutUs.com. That's where you'll find information about my book giveaway. Look for that labeled tab on the top of my homepage. If you like the show, please rate it on iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week, and stay healthy.